Hey everyone, today we cover the last book in the five-part Harry Potter series, Order of the Phoenix. Gonna be honest, it leaves things unresolved.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and while I was reading this long book to my kids, they grew up, went to college, got married, and had their own kids.
All with a lot of angst. And I'm David Vance. I wear glasses and once lived in South America, and I kid you not, the neighborhood kids all called me Harry Potter. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix is a 5,000-page Russian novel about a Leningrad serial killer murdering journalists. It won the Newbery Medal.
And this is the book pile.
So, quick reminder to please rate and review the book pile. This week, there's a special deal where if you leave a review, you get to snog Kellen. Offer only applies to the first 10,000 reviews.
Snogging has got to be the slang word for kissing that has the least onomatopoeia.
Not the way I do it. Snogging is the word that parents gave to kissing to make it sound gross so kids wouldn't do it.
A reviewer named Shisha says, "These guys are very funny. I've never enjoyed a podcast as much as I enjoy listening to the book pile. If you're feeling down, these two are the perfect pick-me-up." That's great.
Yeah, very nice.
It's hard to, like, I don't want to make fun of someone who is, like, using us as an antidepressant.
Well, but if you mock them, then the rest of the episode will be the thing that cheers them up.
Hey, Shisha, you stupid idiot. No, but seriously, thanks.
Finally, our next two books are We Don't Need Roads and Twilight.
And now, as always, there are spoilers ahead, as we might reference plot points from any of the books in this series. So, without further ado, here are our favorite four lessons from Harry Phoenix and the Order of the Potter.
All right, lesson one. Paint from life. So, in Natalie Portman's masterclass, she says you want to paint from life, meaning instead of just recreating what you've seen in other movies or books, you want to take inspiration from the actual world, like what you actually feel or how your friends actually are, so you're not just repeating the cliches you've seen or read in a million different things. So in her career, for instance, she'll be like, okay, how do I feel when my husband is Darth Vader? So in this book, there are all these moments of very specific emotions where you're like, oh, I felt that too. And I think it's because JK is painting from life, where she's just writing very honestly from her own experiences. So when Ron becomes prefect, Harry's reaction is so relatable because he thinks it should have been him and he's awkward about it, but he's happy for Ron and he's mad at himself for thinking he's better than Ron, but he does think he's better than Ron. I don't know. Like, don't we all have that friend where we wouldn't admit it, but we think we're a little better? Or maybe no one else does that, and I just outed myself.
No, I can relate. I mean, that would be if you were made prefect. One other main inconsistency in the books with Ron, along with being good at chess, it's his becoming prefect.
When no one thinks he should be.
Right. And even when he's made prefect, he never wants to do prefect things.
Right.
So,
and even the small victories undercut later when Dumbledore just says that Harry's life was too hard. And that's why he wasn't a prefect.
Well, that's what's insane to me. It's like, yeah, but was Ron really the number two?
That is a fair point. Because Harry and Ron have never obeyed a dang rule in their life. Why are they in charge of enforcement? Same with Hermione.
And like, it's crazy that Ron would even think that he would become an Orr, which is basically like the policeman of the wizarding world. Ron's character, he's so weak that he's unwilling to enforce rules in Hogwarts just because he thinks his brothers will make fun of him.
Another moment of painting from life is just how she portrays grief when Sirius dies. And I feel like you can tell that she's writing based on her own experiences of grief, because Harry can't even say that Sirius is dead or it will feel too permanent to him. And anything that reminds him of Sirius is just this like jolt of pain. It feels like Sirius was just barely there. I just think broadly, painting from life makes that writing feel very real and very relatable.
I have a theory about Sirius because I kind of have a problem with how he acts in the book. He's whiny like Harry. I know that he's shut in his own house or whatever, but he fights so much before this to be with Harry. And then when they have their grand reunion, when Harry makes it to 12 Grimald Place, Sirius just walks up to him and goes, "Hello, Harry. I see you've met my mother."
How do you know he didn't practice that entrance for weeks? He's like, "Okay, be cool, be cool."
Oh, Harry, no, that seems too desperate. But I have this theory that, because aside from that, he's actually not a great family member to Harry. When Harry opens his heart to him and reveals basically just to him that he thinks he's the one who attacked Ron's dad, Sirius just said, "Oh, don't worry about it. It's just a bad dream." Sirius does these things that make him less likable than in the other books. Huh. But J.K. Rowling is such a master writer that I feel like hopefully she just did all that to sort of soften the blow so he wouldn't feel as bad when he died in the most humane capital punishment chamber of all time.
I noticed she did that when Cedric was like, "I just got done cyberbullying some kid. Anyway, let's grab this together." Game of Thrones would actually do the opposite, where they would take this obscure character and try to quickly humanize them and give them a backstory and heart. And you're like, "Oh, that person's dead for sure."
That's the foreshadowing. One more thing about Painting from Life. Who's the guy that they call the Painter of Light, and he basically just paints the same cottage in the woods, like from 1,000 different angles? Thomas Kincaid. I don't know if this is true, but he literally painted from his own life because he would add a drop of his own blood to every painting.
No.
Isn't that bizarre?
That's like some Dorian Gray crap.
And he's so prolific, I'm surprised he never like fainted. But I wonder if it's so that, like, in the future, that'll be his DNA in the amber and he'll be recreated. Thomas Kincaid Park.
And the way it'll work, it'll be like a viral proliferation, because you'll clone him from the drops of blood, and then that guy will make a bunch of portraits, and then he'll clone from the bloody portrait.
All right. Lesson two, evil can seem even worse with a kind facade. My dad tells a story about one time when a driver who, when the light had turned green for my dad and he was in the front, a driver crossing the intersection, he didn't stop. But not only that, like, he didn't just blaze through his own red light. He slowed down. And as everyone was honking at him, he smiled and waved. Which, like, made it so much worse for my dad. Like, my dad was so angry. That's why he was telling us this story. It was because of what this guy did emotionally. And I think that there is some sort of power to this. Like, if you do something mean, but you're nice about it, you move from just rude to terrifying.
It is a great power move to just own that what you're doing is a terrible thing.
So these people who are nice or acting nice when they're being mean, I think these are the people who want to watch the world burn. Mm-hmm. This is the Joker laughing as Batman beats him up, right? And this is also Umbridge, like from her first introduction in the book with sort of this off-screen. She's a malicious person with a sweet voice, and it just makes her that much worse. And I think it works so well because all the other bad people in these stories look and sound like bad guys. Fenrir Greyback is a big, scary wolf of a man, even when he's not a werewolf. Bellatrix is a wild-eyed, emaciated psychopath. Voldemort goes from being the back of a guy's head to an old man baby, to a dude with a snake nose. But Umbridge, for some reason, the way that she acts, it's psychologically excruciating. And I think it's because our brain is saying, like, her voice is a nice person, but she isn't a nice person. And it's different from when, like, Snape is just mean to Harry.
Sure. Well, honestly, I feel like Umbridge's portrayal is probably in many ways the most honest, because I feel like most bad people don't feel like they're bad people.
Mm.
There's this quote from George Saunders that I really like. He says, "The idea is that even the bad guys don't see themselves as such. Have you ever seen those color photos and videos of the SS guys and gals at Auschwitz cutting up on the weekend, singing and dancing and joking and so on? They thought they were the good guys."
Huh. That is Umbridge the whole time. She's just trying to uphold the law. And right. When that doesn't work, she creates more laws. I was trying to think of examples of when this is the other way around. And to me, one of the biggest ones is the guy who shovels snow in Home Alone. It's like the opposite Umbridge, where you think he's this evil murderer. And then, they actually never answered that, but he did save Kevin right. In the end.
I think about that a lot with people like Cillian Murphy, where Cillian Murphy gets cast as the evil guy in almost every movie he's in. And he just looks like that. That's not his fault. He just has a sinister face. And there are people like that scattered across the world who just look evil and get the opposite of the benefit of the doubt because they look like villains.
So one last note on Umbridge. I think that she might be the laziest named character in the Harry Potter universe.
Oh, because of the word.
Because of literally Umbridge. The word Umbridge. Yeah. J.K. Rowling, I think it's fun what she does with other names, or mean people like Snape, you know, have a word that sounds like snake.
Sure.
Or Malfoy sounds malicious. Dumbledore sounds sort of
whimsical.
Whimsical. But yeah, Umbridge is literally means Umbridge.
Firenze sounds like a boring character. Bane sounds like a boring character. Ronan sounds like a boring character.
Kingsley Shacklebolt sounds like a Marvel character.
You know, when Stan Lee read the name Kingsley Shacklebolt, he's like, dang it. Sorry, Stan Lee crumpled up the character Jack Kirby had been working on.
Luna Lovegood, who is one of my favorite characters, seems like it was literally just reverse engineered from Looney, which is what they bully her with.
It's like you name a character Buttheed.
So my takeaway from this is that the next time you do something mean, smile and you will scare people. No, but really, if someone like does something rude to you, rather than being rude back or even turning the cheek, I think it's even more disarming to just give them a crazy grin.
I feel like if I punched someone and they just smiled at me, I would be hesitant to punch them again.
Yeah. You ever see that in movies when like a tough guy gets punched in the face and he feels around with his tongue and he spits out a tooth? Like, there's no way, dude. I've had a tooth pulled, and I don't care who you are, but that's like a 9.
I bet they have the tooth scale in their mouth already, just ready to go.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a great intimidating move. If you're going to get in a fight, stick a tooth in your cheek. And even if they just like hit you in the shoulder, just spit it out.
Or have an extra tongue in there.
Well, that would be extra surprising if instead of fighting, they just wanted to make out with you.
All right, lesson 3. Beware the danger of being proven right once. So this is a short one. So Harry dreams that Mr. Weasley is attacked, and everyone's like, you're imagining it, but he sticks to his guns and he's proven right. And then he dreams that Sirius is attacked and everyone pushes back and he sticks to his guns, and it's the biggest mistake of his life. He kills his godfather. And I think sometimes when you prove the haters wrong once, maybe next time you don't listen to the haters, even though you should. So Steve Jobs had all these groundbreaking products that defied the naysayers. And so later when the haters were like, you probably shouldn't treat cancer with just acupuncture. I think he was just used to being right. Or like Einstein went against the crowd with his theory of relativity. So then he went against the crowd by fighting quantum mechanics for half his life.
I don't think that the haters get enough credit, because like you hear them brought up a lot with successful rappers, but like to be a successful rapper, you have beat the odds by an incredible number. So like maybe you're 1 out of 20,000 who has a number one record that week. And yeah, a bunch of those agents who passed on you were wrong, but they were right about all those other people.
Yeah, there's definitely a sampling bias. I want to do a musical sketch where it's these rappers rapping about all the haters who doubted them and about how their concerns were statistically reasonable.
All right. Lesson 4, you have leeway with pacing if it pays off. I know someone who quit reading this book halfway through. That's theirs.
And just didn't read the rest of the Harry Potter books?
Right. Can you imagine?
Wow.
But
they came this far.
This is right.
I would have at least done the Spark Notes and gone on to the one where Harry gets with Ginny.
So this is a lot of people's least favorite book. People complain that it's long, that it's slow, but I don't care. First of all, like, you're saying the pacing in this was too slow, but War and Peace is perfect. Can I point you to Atlas Shrugged?
My two cents, I want to throw in that the people quitting Harry Potter 5 because it's too long are not reading War and Peace.
First of all, this was for sure the first time that millions of children read a book that was over 800 pages long.
Yeah, do you know what she did to literacy rates?
I don't care. I enjoy being in this world. Let's spend a whole chapter going to Hogsmeade just for some light shopping. Like, I really don't mind.
She probably boosted the nation's reading level with this book. And it's the one with the best lesson because it says, obey and don't get into trouble or your godfather will die. This is genuinely the only Harry Potter book where Harry should have just sat tight.
I can be a snob when it comes to superfluous detail, but J.K. Rowling is already so good at writing things tightly. Can you think of any part of this book that could have been shorter?
I think it could have been longer, because she builds up his pent-up attraction toward Cho for 3 books and then cuts away.
I think that Cho Chang's only purpose is to show us at the end of Harry Potter's story that he at least dated one other person before getting married.
And they seem to have kissed twice, gone on one date, and then ended terribly. If I were Harry, I would have kissed her, leaned back, and been like, you just kissed a piece of Voldemort's soul, girl. Do you think in that moment, hundreds of miles away, Voldemort was like, finally?
I think you can't complain about slow pacing in a book if it eventually pays off. And to me, this book not only pays off the book itself, but it pays off with the hundreds of pages preceding the book. Answers that we have wanted since book one. First of all, a few of the payoffs in the book: Umbridge getting carried away by centaurs, Fred and George's exit, and then the revelation of the prophecy. So my biggest beef with the movie versus the book, other than that the movie didn't include the flying brains.
Kellen is the biggest flying brain stan.
It's just so random to me. I appreciate creativity, but what? Like, I wanted to see like all of them really team up at the end. They've been training with the DA this whole time, and most of them just end up incapacitated by like arbitrary means.
They're fighting a bunch of adults.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
You know, hold on. Our equivalent is you take a bunch of teenagers, put them in karate class, and then they get surrounded by a gang on the streets. They're definitely getting whooped. If they can stay alive just like these teenagers did, then it's like, that's success.
So the craziest thing to leave out in all of the movies is the payoff at the end of this when Dumbledore explains so much. Like, there is such...
They leave it out?
Yeah. There is a larger information dump at the end of this book than in any other book. But in the movie, Dumbledore, he doesn't tell Harry the reason why Voldemort tried to kill him as a baby.
Wow.
And it's such an amazing payoff, the fact that the Trelawney's connection, that answers our question why he kept a crazy useless teacher at this school. it ties in Neville.
It doesn't answer my question why he keeps like 8 useless teachers at the school. Hagrid is so bad at his job. Trelawney's terrible. Snape is a terrible teacher. He knows potions up and down, but no one's learning anything from him. And then every other Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher is a crazed murderer.
It is funny. We've discussed before, like, how much did J.K. Rowling plan before and how much did she make up along the way? But Trelawney, for me, is one of those things that I think sort of came halfway through, because she's one of these teachers that from the beginning, we haven't seen her eating at the table with the other teachers. But J.K. Rowling has a clever way of covering it up with, yeah, I mean, she doesn't eat with them because she's an alcoholic. Whew, covered that plot hole up.
But the first time she introduces her in book 3, she clearly knows how she's going to use her, because Dumbledore is like, you know, that may have been her second true prophecy.
I love that seed. That's true. Yeah.
I will say about the prophecy at the end, like you said, it is a satisfying payoff of a number of threads in the book, but it's also a payoff that changes absolutely nothing. Because by that point, we've been through 5 books of Harry battling Voldemort. We weren't wondering like, oh, do you think McGonagall's going to beat Voldemort? Like, we knew it was going to be Harry. Do you know how mad we would have been if it hadn't been Harry? If book 7 is like the one book where Dumbledore isn't strangely missing during the intense action.
That is a good point. Does it move anything forward?
I don't think so. It's codifying in the form of a prophecy, a promise that was already made implicitly to us as readers in the books themselves.
Mm-hmm. I guess one thing that it does tangentially is that it puts Lucius in Azkaban, which then brings in the motivation for Malfoy to try and fill his father's shoes.
Oh, no, the battle at the ministry changes a bunch.
Which
I think the prophecy,
the motivation for the battle is trying to attain the prophecy. But yeah, that is crazy. I'd never thought of it that way. The prophecy is sort of a useless dead end.
And it would have changed nothing for Voldemort, too, if Voldemort had heard it. It would have just said, oh, I got to kill this kid. This kid I've been trying to kill every book. And Harry hears it and he's like, oh, I got to fight Voldemort. That thing I do every year during exams, I got to keep doing that.
It would have been great if there was a bait and switch and then another bait and switch where they find that this quote unquote weapon is the prophecy. And we're like, oh, okay, didn't see that coming. And then they return and Harry is like, to Dumbledore, we found Voldemort's weapon, the prophecy, but it broke. And Dumbledore's like, no, like, you didn't see the wizard bazooka next to it? We literally told you it was a weapon. You think we meant a crystal ball?
Hermione's always talking about how, like, electronics go haywire around magic. I guarantee you Uzis work. That's, like, purely mechanical. They have, like, flames. I mean, they have dragons and flu powder. I guarantee you that a small tactical force of muggles with Uzis.
To see a wizard just pick up a machine gun, that would have been cool if that were Neville's arc. Where he just picks up, like, a 1930s Gatling gun. And he's like, Expelliarmus is this.
All right, random facts. So I realized lately how much wish fulfillment there is in the first Harry Potter, because it's what every 11-year-old wants to hear. It's like, hey, Harry, I know you seem normal, but you're actually a wizard, and you're the most special wizard who beat Voldemort, and you're famous and rich and an athlete. But keep it a secret or normal people will be jealous. So my family is very anti-Snape, and in Harry Potter, there's a confirmed afterlife. So it's nice to know that Snape's in a place where Lily is always with James. Also, anytime he's really mean to Harry, I take comfort remembering he dies horribly from a snake. if I were Harry in that moment when he dies, I would find it hard to resist the temptation to go up and be like, Severus Snape.
Harry was there when Snape was dying. What if Harry was like, I mean, your last name, you were either going to die this way or from an ape. So I'm making a big assumption here that J.K. Rowling was never bullied in high school because in her mind, you know how bullies, if they really don't like you, they will compose a multiverse song and then memorize it and sing it for you. I have such a problem with the Weasley is our king song. The fact that this even happens, that they're like practicing together with sheet music in the Slytherin dungeon. A 1, 2, 3. Like, this will make him really mad.
There's something incredibly needy about Draco Malfoy and his relationship with Harry, Ron, and Hermione. They never seek him out. He's always seeking them out. Like, I feel like he needs them. Harry's always beating him in every single thing they ever do against each other. It's almost like he has a crush on them. Like, if Draco died, it would affect Harry, Ron, and Hermione not a bit. If they died, I feel like he'd be lonely. So you ever notice how the Harry Potter kids are like pretty bad kids? They never followed a rule in their life. They steal potion supplies. Harry's got a rap sheet. They attack several teachers. Harry cuts up a kid in a bathroom fight. Hermione's blackmailing a prominent journalist. Like, they're objectively not good kids.
Harry assaults Draco Malfoy in this book in a way that, like, with Draco was not the one to make the first move.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Harry's knuckles literally get bruised. Uh-huh. It's like a pretty aggressive thing for our hero to do.
Harry cheats in a major tournament. Two of the three struggle in school, and then they just play hooky for the final year.
So, in the episode that we did on the first Harry Potter book, I joked about you having a prioritized list of the 217 Harry Potter characters. I looked it up. There are 772.
Wow.
It's not unbelievable.
And you would have known that if you'd looked at my list. I read once that Jim Dale set a Guinness World Record for number of voices in an audiobook for this book.
Oh, wow.
I don't understand how Jim Dale would have set it, but Stephen Fry, who did the British version of the book, didn't set it. Was Stephen Fry just consolidating characters? Or was Guinness listening and they're like, oh, those two voices, too similar?
Stephen Fry tells a story about how he could not get the line down that Harry took something and he pocketed it. And so he asked J.K. Rowling personally, could I just say, Harry, put it in his pocket? And she said, no.
And then didn't he say that she then included that phrase in every single book after that point? Oh, did she?
Another problem I have with the movies is that in the books, Harry has this disheveled hair that he can never get right. Hermione has this big bushy hair that she can never tame. But as the movies progress, like Harry and Hermione, they learn how to take care of it. So the actors for Trelawney and Umbridge, Emma Thompson and Imelda Staunton, in real life, they live across the street from each other.
Oh, really?
Which is crazy because, like, Umbridge had Trelawney fired. It's got to be awkward when they do, you do that thing where you, like, pull into your driveways at the same time.
I don't know. I work from home.
Harry whines a lot in this book, and that's probably the biggest complaint from people about mm-hmm. this book. And it is admittedly mine, too. Like, it gets tiresome. But when you go from book to book, I think it feels like a larger amount of time. But Harry is grieving. Like, this book literally picks up 28 days after he saw a student murdered in front of him. So, like, maybe he's allowed to complain a little bit. So if Harry had these dreams where he was literally in Nagini's mind, seeing everything that he did. Do you think that Nagini fell asleep a few times and went on some awkward dates?
All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, the final Harry Potter book. Number one, paint from life. Two, evil is even worse with a kind facade. Three, beware the danger of being proven right once. Four, you have leeway with pacing if it pays off.
And five, marry the second person you ever date.